So today our text is going to begin at 1 Samuel 29. We're going to bleed over a little bit into chapter 30 also, but we're going to start with 1 Samuel 29. And we're going to see how David in these verses chooses faith, and that leads ultimately to victory for him. Because life has often been compared to a roller coaster, and we've all, been around long enough, probably we've been on that roller coaster. Within the course of a week, a day, or an hour, we can go from what feels like the greatest victory to the lowest low, and just feel like everything just dropped out unexpectedly. And this isn't a new phenomenon. It's gone on for time immemorial. And so today we're going to see how David rode the roller coaster in these chapters. It starts out with David receiving favor. So let's read from chapter 29, verse 1. 1 Samuel, that is. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, while the Israelites were camping by the spring, which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines were proceeding on by hundreds and by thousands. And David and his men were proceeding on in the rear with Achish. Then the commanders of the Philistines said, 'What are these Hebrews doing here?' And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, 'Is this not David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, who has been with me these days, or rather these years? And I have found no fault in him from the day he deserted to me to this day.' But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, 'Make the man go back, that he may return to his place where you have assigned him. And do not let him go down to battle with us, or in the battle he may become an adversary to us. For with what could this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of these men? Is this not David, of whom they sing in the dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? We'll stop there for the moment. And, last time we saw Israel gathering there at Jezreel. There's that fountain there, that stream there, and they were there at Jezreel, and Saul had this great fear as he looked across the plain and saw the Philistines. Now we're hearing about this massive army of the Philistines there. At that time, it didn't tell us why he was so afraid, but now we can see why. He's looking at this army that was coming out by hundreds and thousands. I mean, this is a huge army that's going to face him, and probably his, if I remember right, 2,000 men. And so, the way the Philistines work things is each city would have a commander, and that commander then would bring all his men. And so they were very organized. And this is one of the things that made the Philistines such a mighty power back then, is they were so organized in their military. Unlike Israel, that was kind of loosely governed under, one king, and they just like, hey, we need people, and stuff, from wherever you are, come, send out a bugle call. Whereas these guys, had more direct control. Said, hey, all you guys in my city, you're going with me now to this. And the Philistines also were to be feared because of their iron weapons. They had learned how to smelt iron before Israel did, it turns out. Remember back in 1 Samuel 13, we read of how the Israelites, when they needed like a metal plowshare or whatever, they went down to the Philistines to get it. And that's because the Philistines had mastered this technology before Israel had, apparently. And so that's why they were so much better than militarily also. Because you think about it, if you have some evenly matched soldiers, like you've got 50 here and 50 there, and these guys have, wooden weapons, and these guys have metal weapons, steel, or not steel, but iron, well, that would make those soldiers stronger that had the iron weapons, because they had superior, weapons. We've all seen that, metal can, break a piece of wood pretty easily or cut it or whatever. You don't often see wood breaking iron, So they would have a real advantage there. Just imagine the Israelites fighting with spears, and maybe only Saul and we know Jonathan had a sword. We don't know if any others even had a sword. So you can see how they had an advantage in that way too. Well, at the back of this large procession of Philistines then are David and his men. We see that in verse 2. And that leads to some objections from the Philistine commanders. The first objection in verse 3 is that David and his men are Hebrews. Now, we see that and we think, well, is that anti-Semitism? That's not anti-Semitism going on, but it's common sense. they're like, we're going to war with the Hebrews, and we got Hebrews behind us. This doesn't look good. You know, we've got them on both sides. This can't be a wise way to go into battle. That's an obvious conflict of interest for David and his soldiers. And they reasonably fear then, from verse 4, that David and his men, once they get into battle, may flip on them and decide, we're going to attack from the rear, just like I'm suggesting. And they suggest further, well, how could David gain favor again with Saul other than to do that? You know, to join in the battle that Saul's in by killing all these Philistines. In fact, we've seen this happen before in 1 Samuel, back in chapter 14, verse 21. Remember the great victory that was brought about by Jonathan and his armor bearer, these two going to battle, and then all that unleashes after that with all of Israel joining in the attack against the Philistines. And there were these Israelites who had already defected to the Philistines at that time. And when they saw this victory and all this that was going on by the Israelites, they flipped back over to Saul's side. And they said, hey, we're going to fight with our people now. You know, and so this actually had already happened once in 1 Samuel. And then they finally make the case in verse 5 of, you know, look at the guy you're letting follow you up here. It's David, this famous warrior. David has killed thousands, it says, and that includes tons of Philistines. You know, and we haven't forgotten that. And probably some of them remember Goliath, too. You know, that he killed mighty Goliath. They even know this famous song and dance for David. You know, it's like the top of the Billboard charts back then, I guess, was this song. Everyone knew it, you know. And so they're like, let's not take this accomplished warrior into battle. This is too dangerous. This guy's like a live hand grenade behind us. We don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, I said that there was favor here. This isn't really favor so far. This is more like acknowledgement, you know, of this guy. Like, we're afraid of him. We acknowledge who he is. But where's the favor? We're going to see the favor now as you read further from 1 Samuel 29, verse 6. It says, then Achish called David and said to him, as the Lord lives, you have been upright, and your going out and your coming in with me in the army are pleasing in my sight. For I have not found evil in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, you are not pleasing in the sight of the Lord's. Now, therefore, return and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. David said to Achish, but what have I done, and what have you found in your servant from the day when I came before you to this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? But Achish replied to David, I know that you are pleasing in my sight, like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, he must not go up with us to the battle. Now then, arise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who have come with you, and as soon as you have arisen early in the morning and have light, depart. So David arose early, he and his men, to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel. And so this is where we see the favor. I mean, look at all this glowing praise of David from Achish. I mean, he says, you know, really wonderful things about him. He says in verse 6 that you're upright. You know, I've seen no evil in you. And verse 9, I love that. He says, you're like an angel of God. I mean, wow, what praise. You know, like an angel of God. Now, we know David hasn't really been an angel to Achish, you know. We know what's been going on. He's been fooling Achish here is what's been going on. I mean, David is a godly man, don't get me wrong. But he's been engaging in some deception under Achish's nose there. He's out attacking these enemies of Israel, but telling Achish that he's fighting against, you know, the Israelites instead, you know. So he's been kind of pulling one over his eyes a little bit. But, you know, in reality, Achish is the enemy. I mean, that is the enemy of David, the Philistines. And we kind of lose that because they had this good relationship. But, you know, David hasn't forgotten who his real enemy is. It's the Philistines. They're right now going to attack his people. So he hasn't forgotten who his real enemy is. And I like how, you know, Achish, you know, you can see Achish has like a long-term plan. You know, it's like, David, you know, I'm trying to set you up politically so you're in good with these lords, you know, these other Philistines. It's like he's got this long-term plan for David. He really thinks David is just going to be his bro forever. You know, he asked him to be his bodyguard for life, you know, and he really thinks that's what David's going to do. But we know that's not what David wants to do. But I would like to challenge us all with this, that, you know, maybe David didn't deserve quite all this praise that he got from Achish. But, you know, as believers, we want to live such lives that we do earn that sort of praise. Now, we're not looking for praise from people, don't get me wrong, but we want people to see these sorts of things in our lives, you know, is what I'm trying to say. We should be known for our purity as Christians, you know, not for sin in our lives. I mean, to me, it is disturbing how many believers today are trying so hard to look like the world, you know, especially, I think, those who are younger in age. You know, they don't want to stand out. You know, they kind of want to blend. They want to be cool and all this sort of thing. But, you know, it's not really possible for us to do. I mean, it's not possible for the Christians to look like the world because the world is really consumed with sin. I mean, that's what the world's into. You know, the world is at odds with the things of God. And so we really can't fit in here, you know, to a complete extent. I mean, that doesn't mean we can't have friends, obviously, and have good relationships with lost people that we're hoping to win to Christ. But, you know, we're never going to fit in perfectly and have a healthy walk with God. It's just not going to work out because there's so many things that people in the world want to talk about and they want to do that, you know we don't want to do that because we know those things are an offense to God. We want to follow God. We want to honor God with our lives. Believers also should be pointing people to godliness. I mean, you think about how Achish said, you've been like an angel of God. I mean, what a strong word of praise for somebody to say that about them. And that's what should be coming out of our lives, you know, is that godliness, and people see that. And from being around us, people get a taste of what it's like to know the Lord because they see you, you know, and they see, wow, this person is so different, you know, and what they're seeing is the Lord in us is what they're seeing. We want them to see Jesus through our lives, that we are his hands and feet, as we often say. Now, in verse 8 there, David, you know, feigns kind of a protest there that, you know, why can't I go fight with you? You know, you're so great, all this stuff. Only to be warmly told again by Achish, you know, you can't go. You know, you must not go. But we think about David inside. I mean, this must have been a huge relief for him, you know, for him to get this word from Achish that you can't go. I mean, he must have been on cloud nine to escape this difficult predicament. I mean, he's going with an army against his own people. You know, that would not, I mean, now maybe in his mind he's thinking, I'm just going to attack the Philistines when we get there. We don't know. He doesn't tell us. The word doesn't tell us. But what a predicament to be in. You know, you can't imagine. It's like your bluff got taken all the way to the extreme, and now you're being asked to fight against your own people. Whoops, I didn't plan on that. But we see how good our God is, you know, even when we're not good. I mean, some of the stuff David's been doing, you know, the Bible isn't necessarily honoring that. It isn't saying, hey, this is a good thing to do, to lie to people and, you know, do all this stuff. It's not saying that at all. And so David obviously hasn't been all on the up and up here. We talked about how when he went to live with the Philistines, that was him really having a lack of faith, you know, that God could preserve him there in Judah, you know, without Saul getting to him. And so he started off this whole thing on kind of a faithless journey. But I think all of us can kind of see ourselves in David's place here. And we recognize how good our God is, even when we're not, because we've all made a big mistake at some point in our lives. And, you know, God has rescued us from the results that might have been. We've probably all had some experience like that in our lives, or we've known someone who has, where it's like, man, this could have gone really, really bad, you know, and the Lord preserved me, you know, and kept me from, you know, the terrible circumstances that might have come out of this. I mean, I just reflect on how we depend on his grace every day. I mean, he saves us in so many ways we don't even know. You know, he protects us. It's amazing. And we don't deserve it. We just have to give him praise. But next we're going to see some failure in David's life. He's kind of up on a high right now. He's going to go down into a low here for a little bit. From chapter 30, verse 1, 1 Samuel 30. Then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. Now David's two wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. David had taken his soldiers with him into battle. There is what had happened. All 600 of them had gone. And that's where the failure comes in, because unfortunately it had left Ziklag and their families completely undefended, you know, vulnerable to attack is what happened. Especially when you consider Ziklag was 50 miles away from Aphek. You know, and that's a good journey for us today. You know, that's like an hour's drive, roughly. Well, then it was like 3 days' journey, you know, to walk that far, you know, to travel that far. It would take them 3 days is what it told us here. It took them 3 days. And so when you consider that it took them 3 days to come back, well, it probably took them 3 days to get there too. So they've been gone a minimum of 6 days, maybe a whole week. And with so many of the Philistines going to battle, it was not hard for the Amalekites to sort of read what was going on and say, ah, this is a good time to get some revenge on David, you know, to go after him. Because the Amalekites, you know, they've always been an enemy with Israel. So even though, you know, David is there with the Philistines, they're like, you know, this is a good shot for us to get out some of these guys. And that's exactly what they're going to do, or what they did. Now, the other Philistine cities had nothing to fear, so it was fine for them to take all these soldiers with them. They were marching to meet their enemy, which is Israel. But, you know, as David has been raiding amongst the Amalekites, you know, and there's been war between Israel and the Amalekites for a long time, David left an enemy behind. You know, there was still an enemy there that could come after his people, and that's exactly what they did. Now, in David's defense, it might have looked a little suspicious if he had said, hey, I want to leave some soldiers here in my hometown. You know, like, why do you want to do that, David? Well, I've been messing with the Amalekites a little bit, you know, that's why, that's, you know, but he wasn't going to tell them that, you know, so, but he didn't leave them, obviously. And so David had failed to really protect his people at this point, even his own family, his two wives and any children that they already had. He then finds himself at risk of being stoned by his men. You know, these loyal men have been following him all these years, almost 10 years now. Maybe you've noticed that happens. You know, when there's a failure like this, people are often harder on the leaders than they are on themselves in the situation. I mean, clearly none of them thought of this. You know, I mean, David's followers didn't think about this happening either. But David should have known better, you know, because he's the leader. He should have known better is basically their opinion. It's his fault. Let's get him. And David, of course, I'm sure, was kicking himself over this too. I mean, how could I have been so stupid, you know, to leave them unprotected like this? But yet again, God was so gracious to David and to all of these men, because it tells us that no one was harmed, even though they were taken captive. You know, they could have come in and wiped them out, you know, and yet God be praised, they did not do that. Now, there's an expression we have in our society that is, you know, you can't keep a good man down. And perhaps more accurately, we should say, you can't keep God's man down. And that's what we're going to see here in David. We're going to see David win a victory now, is our next point in our message here. It all starts with David's choice that we read there in verse 6. I'll read it again. It says, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And, you know, this is really the key verse in our study today. If you don't remember anything else I said, I hope you remember this verse. You know, this is really the focus, that David strengthened himself in the Lord. Now, your translation may say he encouraged himself in the Lord is another translation, because the Hebrew word translated here means to be strong or to have courage or to strengthen. And so David chose a position of faith in God. Is what happened. Using a New Testament phrase, we would say he renewed his mind here. You know, he got his mind back on what's true. He got his mind back on what God's able to do. This looks really bad, but what can God do? You know, he got his mind back on the Lord to believe that this wasn't the end for him and his people, that, you know, he's going to have victory here. We're going to look closer at David's military victory coming up here. But we don't want to miss that this is where that victory began. This is the point where the victory began. There wouldn't have been a victory on the field without this victory in David's mind. If he had had no faith, he wouldn't have been on that field. He wouldn't have gone after these guys. Like, well, okay, I guess I got to find some more wives, you know, or just one wife, David, really is all you're supposed to have. And, you know, many try to say that having faith is for the weak, that faith is for the weak. But David strengthened himself in his faith. Faith can be weak if it's in someone who themselves is weak. If our faith is in the wrong object, But when we trust in Almighty God, this is not weak. God can handle our problems. God is strong. And as we believe, we can have boldness and strength too from him. And now David chose to believe, but then he makes another choice. Let's read some more. In verses 7 and following, we see that he chose to listen to God. 1 Samuel 30, verse 7. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, please bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them? And he said to him, pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all. And so this choice to listen to God is just as important as the first choice was. In fact, this should be the logical next step of that first choice. That first choice is, you know, God, I believe you're able, that you can handle this situation. And so the next question is, what should I do? You know, what do you want me to do in this situation? And, you know, as a person of faith, we want to discover God's plan. And so we look for what God's plan is. Now, we all know that discovering God's plan can be difficult. I don't mean to make it sound like it's always really simple to do that. But we keep pursuing and we keep looking for what God's will is. And clearly, this is a choice here also, this choice to listen to God, not just do what I think, but to listen to God. And what do you think, God? What do you want me to do here? Now, David did this, it says, with the ephod. And we've talked about this in previous studies of how that ephod contained the Urim and Thummim stones and how they would use those stones to discern God's will at that time. Well, we don't have those stones today. We don't use stones to discern God's will. We listen to God in other ways. We listen to God, you know, by staying among the people of God. By being in fellowship, we can listen to God. We listen to God by staying in the Word of God. We listen to God by staying connected to Him in prayer. Through these things, we are putting ourselves in that place where we can hear God's will for our lives. Now, we never want to be presumptuous about God's will, but we should have a feeling or an attitude of expectancy that God is going to speak to me. You know, God is going to lead me. If I seek Him, He will lead me. And that's that position of faith. Well, David heard God speak, and now he had another choice. That was his third choice, and that is David now, next we're going to see, chose to obey God. He chose to obey in 1 Samuel 30, verse 9. It says, so David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Bezor, where those left behind remain. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 who were too exhausted to cross the brook Bezor remained behind. And so we're clearly seeing the progression here. We believe God, we listen to God, and now we follow God and what He tells us to do. And that's the walk of faith that we all desire. I hope, anyways, that everyone who hears this desires that, you know, to have that faith walk. But just like sometimes happens to us, David's walk of faith has some bumps in it, you know, doesn't it? I mean, we saw this right here, that 200 of his men become too tired to continue in verse 10. And it's a small wonder. They come to this brook Bezor. When you think of a brook, you think of like this little stream, and you think, oh, you just step over it, right? Maybe walk a couple rocks over it or something like that. Sounds like no problem. Well, actually, this was a ravine. It was a large ravine. It would be formed by floodwaters, you know, in the spring and such. It was about 300 to 400 feet wide and had steep, treacherous sides on either side of it. And so it was very difficult to make it across this ravine. It was not a simple thing. Now, it wasn't the Grand Canyon, but it was still difficult to cross. And so some of them come up, they've been marching all this time, they come up to it and they go, oh man, I can't do that. You know, I'm too tired. There's no way. I'm going to get halfway down that wall and I'm going to plummet to the bottom. So, I'm out, basically, is what they say. 200 of his men, in fact, are not going to be able to make it. Now, this is not something we expect in this account. You know, I mean, we've been tracking with this. We see David has faith. David has God's plan. We expect nothing but a triumphant march to victory. You know, that's got to be next. I mean, that's your Hollywood movie right there. But no, one-third of his army decide they're going to sit this one out. You know, they just say, you know, Lord bless you, we'll be here, you know, let us know how it goes. And, you know, might I suggest here, I don't think it's a stretch, that this would have been a test for David. I mean, it certainly would have been for most of us. You know, I mean, talk about, you know, deflating the balloon a little bit. 200 of your soldiers, you know, these aren't like women and children or, you know, young people or, you know, something, people that had some problem that obviously they couldn't make that cross because it was a difficult way to cross. No, these are soldiers, you know, 200 of your soldiers say, can't do it. You know, I'm not going. You're like, what? What are you talking about? In fact, you know, this sort of thing does, though, happen to a lot of times to believers as we step out in God's will for us. In fact, I've seen many believers allow a setback to throw them out of God's will for them. You know, sort of like these 200 men. I've had friends in past churches who were, you know, so excited about some ministry God had for them, and they couldn't stop talking about it, and they just were, you know, thrilled about it. But then all of a sudden it got hard. You know, at some point it got hard. Maybe it was taking more time than they thought it would to do this ministry. Maybe they had some sort of disagreement with somebody in leadership or something like that. Maybe everything but the kitchen sink was being thrown at them in their lives. I mean, that happens too. You know, sometimes all this crazy stuff happens. It's not always negative either. Sometimes, you know, it's like a job promotion or something like that, and all of a sudden they're way busier, you know, than they expected. Whatever it is, because of these things, maybe it was an ugly thing, maybe not, this person, you know, decides to back away, you know, from what God had for them. But, you know, all these circumstances may have changed, but it doesn't in any way change God's revealed will. God's will was the same thing. Now, these circumstances change, and we don't like that, but God's will hadn't changed. And so these things become tools in the hands of the enemy in the life of that believer. And it leads the believer then to turn away from what God had shown them was his will for them and to kind of shrink back a little bit. You know, sometimes even shrinking back really in unbelief, we might say. And so just, you know, as believers, we want to pass this test. When these sort of things come our ways, we want to pass this test and not be fooled by the enemy and in missing all the blessing God has for us. Because ministry is sometimes hard. I mean, that's just the reality. But, you know, truthfully, anything that's worthwhile in this life is difficult. You know, generally, there are hard points in it. You think about those of us who have raised children and such, or are raising children. There are points in it that aren't so pleasant, you know. But still, it's worthwhile, isn't it, to raise a child in this world. And our ministry, then, is something that's very worthwhile. I mean, God is going to celebrate our ministry someday in heaven. That's where we're going to receive reward from the Lord for that. And so that ministry we have, whether that's inside the church, whether that's outside the church, any ministry we have is worthwhile. And so we can expect sometimes it's going to be hard going. Well, David passes the test. You know, these 200 men, they can't go. Well, David just must have assumed God can do this through 400 men. You know, we're gonna keep going. You know, no harm, no foul against these guys. I understand this is a difficult path, and you know, they're just exhausted, so we have mercy on them. You guys just stay here. We're gonna go on without you. And sometimes that happens in following God as well, that we leave some behind at that ravine, as it were. Now, we don't want that to happen, but sometimes it happens. You know, people get distracted, people move away, you know, people backslide sometimes, tragically. But again, that doesn't change God's call for us. You know, just because someone else maybe got tired out, like David, we want to press on, you know, to see that victory that the Lord has. As David presses on, though, we see another parallel to our walk of faith, and that is, as he's on the path, you know, following God, he gets more direction from God after he's already started. Let's read 1 Samuel 30, verse 11. Now they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread and he ate, and they provided him water to drink. They gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins and he ate. Then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. David said to him, "To whom do you belong, and where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites and on that which belongs to Judah and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. Then David said to him, will you bring me down to this band? And he said, swear to me, my God, that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band. So I apologize for talking about food before lunchtime, you know, but it's in the text. I apologize. But David gets more direction here is what happens. And, you know, perhaps what frustrates believers the most in seeking God's will is the fact that he doesn't lay out the whole plan end to end for us. I mean, that's what we really want. You know, we want to see, like, how's this all going to work, God? You know, I'm ready to step out in faith if I can see how this is really going to work, you know, is what we want. But God doesn't do that, does he? He doesn't give us the whole plan. He always just gives us the next step. That's God's way, is to give us the next step. And there's a reason for that. I mean, it keeps us walking in faith and dependence upon him. If he showed us the whole end-to-end thing, we would think, wow, I got it, God. Don't need to listen to you anymore. I'm just going to go ahead, you know? But God doesn't do that. We can't take off without him. And we don't know where we're supposed to go. You know, we've got to depend on him and listen for that next instruction. And so God just sort of gets us moving and tells us when to make the next turn. You know, sometimes nowadays everyone uses their phones a lot of times for directions in the car. But you think about when you've had someone in the back seat directing you in times past, maybe. And, you know, there's that co-pilot that tells you, okay, a mile from now there's going to be a tree. And then after that's a light. And then you're going to turn right. And you're like, okay, I can look for these things. And then there's that person that says, turn now. You know, and so God's more like the last one. You know, he's more like, turn now. You know, this is it. You know, that's more how God does it tends to be, at least in my life, maybe not in yours. And David's direction here comes from a very unlikely source. It comes from this Egyptian slave. Now, this man was not speaking prophetically. He wasn't speaking the words of the Lord or anything like that. He wasn't even a believer. But David sees in this guy the provision that they needed next from the Lord. And that is, they needed a guide. They needed someone who could lead them to where the Amalekites were. And God provides it through this Egyptian. Not only does he say he can lead them to the band, as he calls them, but also lets them know what else they've been doing, who else they've been raiding. They had raided the Cherethites, which is interesting because the Cherethites, from what we can gather, was actually an ally of the Philistines, which the Amalekites were too. So this is kind of strange that they attacked someone like that. That could come back to haunt them. But they also attacked in Judah, it said, and also Caleb, which we recognize Caleb as another tribe of Israel. But David now, he's gotten this more direction that the Lord's provided. And finally, we're going to see in our verses, he's going to experience victory. Let's read from 1 Samuel 30, verse 16. It says, when he had brought him down, behold, they were spread over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. David slaughtered them from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. But nothing of theirs was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back. So David had captured all the sheep and the cattle, which the people drove ahead of the other livestock. And they said, this is David's spoil. So David has a great victory here. They come upon this huge army, and this army is not ready for battle. You know, they think they're all alone out there, and they're just celebrating. They're having this big party. They're drinking, they're dancing, they're eating. They're like, hey, this is great. You know, let's enjoy everything we stole from these other people. But now the party's over, you know, because David and his 400 soldiers who are not there to party, they're there to battle, have shown up. Notice, too, that 400 Amalekites escape. And so if 400 escape and yet David is, you know, they're basically slaughtering these people for like a day. You can imagine, this must have been a huge army there. Maybe 2,000 people, I'm guessing. It had to be enormous for them to take that long for them to slaughter them. And still 400 people escape, you know, which is some subset of it. Well, not only does David get back what was his, what was taken from Ziklag, but they take even more spoil, because now they've got the spoil of all those other defeated people that David takes as well. And don't you just love how God does this sort of thing? I mean, we started off here in chapter 30 looking at a terrible defeat for David. I mean, your home is burned, your family is taken, your property is all taken. But God restores all that to David, and then some, you know, with interest, we might say. And David is not the only believer to have experienced this sort of thing from God. God is the God of the second chance, isn't he? And I love what it says in Joel chapter 2, verse 25. It says, God says there, I will make up to you for the years that the swarming locust has eaten. And a lot of us have probably experienced that in our lives, where we've gone through some difficult time and it seems like such a low. And then afterwards, there's so much blessing afterwards, like, wow, it just totally blows my mind. I actually ended up better off than I was to start with, you know, and the Lord did all that, even though it was through this very difficult and ugly place that I would never want to have to go through again. But David's victory here all started back there with in verse 6, with David having chosen to have faith. It all started there. That's where the victory started. After that, then, remember, he listened to God, and then he obeyed God. Even when it was rough, even when it was confusing, he obeyed God. And that led to this victory. And I just want to submit that, you know, that can lead to victory in our lives too. These same things that we saw David doing, but it all starts with us having faith in the Lord and trusting in the Lord. Let's close then with prayer. Lord God, you just amaze us. And we're just so amazed in your sovereignty, really, of how things, when they seem out of control to us, they're not out of your control. And how you've got a plan and how you're working in our lives and in the things that we just don't even understand sometimes. And we're just so amazed by you and so in wonder of who you are. And we pray that you would help us, God, to live these things out in our lives. Help us, Lord, to be people who choose to have faith, to be people who listen to you, God, to seek out your will for our lives, and to be people that obey you, even in difficult times, God. Those are the things we want. That's the desire of our heart. And we pray for your equipping and your power to do these things. In Jesus' name, amen.